Tonight's thriller contains scenes of suspense and violence which may be unsuitable for young viewers. Parental discretion is advised.
I can see where this is going. But I'm telling you that those things exist.
Thank you, Officer Ripley. That will be all.
Please, you're not listening to me. Kane, the crew member. Kane, who went into that ship, said he saw thousands of eggs there. Thousands.
Thank you. That will be all.
God damn it, that's not all. Because if one of those things gets down here, then that will be all. And all this bullshit that you think is so important, you could just kiss all of that goodbye.
In 1979, we discovered in space, no one can hear you scream. In 1992, we will discover on Earth, everyone can hear you scream.
Mommy!
Oh, God.
I'm not gonna leave you, Newt. I mean that. That's a promise.
You promise?
I cross my heart.
And hope to die.
Mark Verheyden offers notes on the writing of Aliens comics. Mike Richardson put a lot on the line to secure the rights for the book. If the series flopped on release, Dark Horse would have been stuck with a lot of pretty unsellable pictures. In hindsight, it's easy to chuckle over our apprehensions, but there really hadn't been that many movie-related successes in the comics world, and science fiction comics were anathema. But we never condescended to the books, tossing them off as quickie commercial product to make a few bucks. We were serious. We meant business. And to say we were surprised by the success of Aliens would be an understatement. I guess you could say we had a hit on our hands, which led to one of those good problems. You see, I'd never envisioned the Aliens series as an ongoing, talk about optimistic, and yet it became obvious that readers were interested in seeing more of Newt, Hicks, and the other characters. There were also some massive loose ends left hanging, most particularly those concerning a popular female character who played a major role in the first two movies and yet never appeared in the comic. And I'm not talking about Jones the Cat. The second series, with spectacular airbrushed artwork by Dennis Bovaes, was an attempt to expand on the alien mythos, dealing directly with the madness of unrestrained power. That series led to Earth War, which reintroduces Ripley and takes her story and Newt's full circle. Earth War concludes Newt's comic book story, but with a third alien film in the works and more Dark Horse stories on the way, you can bet that the alien will do what it does best, endure and survive.
Listen up, Corporal Hicks, we got you. Just a few more seconds for the cycle to finish.
No. Hang on, Corporal.
Whoa. I got you.
Ripley.
Corporal, I know you've got a lot to come to grips with right now, but where is the rest of your crew?
You're looking at it.
Let's begin at the beginning. You had bought Aliens. Did you carry forward into Earth War?
I carried forward into Earth War, I think. I'm trying to remember the order of things. Aliens, Book 2, Earth War. This was right around the time when they were starting to hype up Aliens versus Predator, which I think kept that hype train going. Doing the Dark Horse Presents tie-ins and the miniseries Genocide and Hive. See, the fact that I can remember the titles means I bought them. But the minute I start forgetting the titles, I don't know what the fuck this is. I'm sure I bought 5 or 6 of the miniseries in succession and was very faithful to following it, almost as if it was an ongoing series. And then I think somewhere along the way, it jumps a long gap. 1995, 1996. I'm vaguely familiar with some of the stuff, but didn't read it faithfully or at all. And maybe if I did check it out, it was because it was a cheap back issue. And I think the next time I focused on it again was when they had John Byrne do those 2-page... I think they were like in previews or something.
Excerpt from 2017's Aliens, the original comic series, Volume 2 hardcover by Mark Verheyden. The first Aliens comic series ended on an ambivalent note, and there were still a few surviving characters. So he decided to pick up where the first series left off, with the Ripley character still off limits for licensing reasons. The second series opens with poor Newt stuck in the ultimate dysfunctional relationship with an alien who's lost his lower half, heading into space on a mysterious freighter with her acid-disfigured friend Hicks. Where the story went from there was was dictated to some extent by the vivid full-color airbrush illustrations from artist Den Bouvez. Where the first Alien story was all drippy black and white horror, this one is going to be Technicolor in all its gory glory. Given that, I decided to go for something with a bit more action, never losing the horror of the xenomorphs, but taking full advantage of Bouvez's knack for creating amazing kick-ass marine versus alien battles. Pitting our heroes against a psychotic military officer who was convinced the alien creatures could be trained gave us plenty of opportunities to explore our characters and, frankly, shoot at a lot of stuff. I'd also like to think I learned a little bit about writing comics after the first series, and so part 2 was intentionally a bit less dense in terms of story. You can only cram so much material into a word balloon. When book 2 turned out to be an even bigger hit than the first series, we decided to have one more go at Newt and Hicks with an eye toward closing the storyline out. But there was one big surprise. I'm not sure how the decision was made, but suddenly we'd been granted permission to use the Ripley character, which was fantastic, of course, but also required a little thought, since she had been notably absent from poor Newt's life in the earlier stories. So Earth War was a chance to explain Ripley's absence, bring her back into the life of the damaged girl she had rescued years earlier, and give both her and Newt a degree of closure. This, along with plenty of double crosses, political machinations, and intense alien action, fed the story engines for the last installment. Earth War's art was done by Sam Keith, who brought a fresh, idiosyncratic style to the alien's world. His delicate line work was a new look for the series, especially the character designs, but his aliens were just as mean and nasty as ever. Sam went on to great success with his character the Max and other work, so I'm happy we managed to catch him early. And that was my swan song on the aliens titles. I had told the tale I wanted to tell, and there were others eager to jump into the alien comic book pool. As I've gone on to work in film and television, I've discovered that these early aliens comics managed to make quite an impact on some folks back in the day. I can't tell you how many meetings I've had where a comic savvy executive will compliment me on the series, usually followed by, "I bought them all when I was 14. Nor will I ever stop appreciating the kindness of fans who find me at the rare, for me, convention appearance, and take out carefully tended copies of the original books. Apparently, Aliens vs. Predator writer-director Paul W.S. Anderson was also a fan, since despite my not being involved in the team-up books, he opted to name an unfortunate character in his movie after yours truly. I will say that my character died real good, and the AVP trading cards with Verhaeden on them are pretty cool. I suppose as a writer, you hope at least some of your work will have a life beyond the initial sales period. I'm a lucky guy, because at this writing, my 3 alien stories have been in print for almost 30 years, and who knows, with the ongoing comics continuing from Dark Horse and the promise of more alien movies on the way, maybe there's another 30 in the cards.
I was alone. All was quiet. Then I saw something move in the equipment bay. The creature had escaped with me into the Narcissus. Now, after wreaking carnage, it seemed to be resting.
Lucky, lucky, lucky.
By the time it woke up, I had pressured up a suit and loaded the harpoon gun. I got to the egress panel just as it reached me. I blew the hatch, flushed it, harpooned it, and roasted it with the thrusters. Now I'm safe aboard the shuttle and ready for hypersleep. I've set a course for home and I've got the ship's cat with me. Amanda, if all you hear from me is this message, I took this job to give us a future. The company should hold my back pay in trust for you. If we're lucky, we'll spend it together. I love you. Mom. Personal log out.
I decided to take a brief look at Dark Horse before Aliens, especially immediately before. And you've got things like Wizard of 4th Street, which was canceled 2 issues into a proposed 6-issue miniseries. You got Dark Horse Presents and some of the spinoffs like Concrete and Trekker. The American, you've got some early American manga in Mecha. You've got The Mark, which I think Larry Stroman got a start on that, but never had much of an impact. Wacky Squirrel, they raided other publishers and got stuff like Flaming Carrot, Mr. Monster, and Roach Mill. Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to diminish any of these creators or the creations, but this is small-time shit. Let's just be real about it.
I'll just back you up. Some of the stuff that you mentioned, I'm familiar with, but I'm not familiar with it because I was reading it at the time or anything. Most of that stuff that you mentioned, like the American, Trekker, Concrete, those kind of things, those I all either discovered later in life or, shamedly, I'm not very well read on, but I am aware of them. I don't think there was much Dark Horse action until the licensed properties came along, the things that got me to look in their general direction.
What's happening when you're looking at those licensed books? You're seeing house ads for those concepts. There's a very good chance that you had no idea what the American was until you saw it in an issue of Godzilla or the Abyss adaptation. After Aliens, they're doing Robert E. Howard. They were among the first of the republishers of Japanese manga with books like Outlanders. Chevelle Noir, which was their take on heavy metal, essentially, where they were repackaging as an anthology foreign comics. And that ran for almost 5 years. I forget how long that ran for because they only had the Dave Stevens cover on like the first one. So that's why you had stuff like Brian Talbot's Adventures of Luther Arkwright, which again, not a hugely impactful book, but well remembered. And I think maybe got a broader audience through association with all the adaptations. And then by the time you get to Earth War, they're really getting on fire. And I think one of the reasons why these miniseries play out the way that they do is because every time an issue of an Alien book comes out, they've got money to do more stuff. I don't think that there are contenders when they're putting out Flaming Carrot. But when they make it enough money, when they're selling hundreds of thousands of copies, all of a sudden they're a viable alternative to DC and Marvel. And people who are maybe not happy with the two company system are starting to look their way. And I think about a lot of the mini majors of the time that did not survive the boom. First comic, you would have thought they'd have been riding high during the boom, but they collapsed. They went into bankruptcy. Basically, all the chickens came home to roost and they were just gone. Where Dark Horse was able to build and build throughout those years, every time they put out an issue of Alien, all of a sudden Frank Miller's like, well, maybe I can do Sin City in Dark Horse Presents. You mentioned John Byrne. Well, he's in his 40s and he's trying to figure out what his Fantastic Four is going to be. So he decides that he's going to do Next Men over at Dark Horse. Miller, having been so anti-corporate and having been able to float himself for a while on that Hollywood money when he was doing screenplays, he comes back and he's got Give Me Liberty with Dave Gibbons. He's got Hard Boiled with Jeff Darrow. Dark Horse themselves have the chance to experiment. They do The Mask, which is a modest hit. They start doing more adaptations, some hits, some misses. They try to do The Thing from Another World. They try to do Indiana Jones, and that was successful for a little while. But of course, as you say, the big ones, Aliens versus Predator and Star Wars, the crown jewel. And once they had Star Wars, and once Star Wars was a perpetual money machine, endlessly since Dark Horse brought them back, Marvel kicked Star Wars to the curb because they wanted to have room on their slate for fucking new universe. And then Dark Horse comes around and treats that property with respect, and they've got a whole line of books for decades. And then Marvel still fucking has a whole line of Star Wars books after all these years. Aliens, at what point, once they got over the hump, once they got over Earth War, I think was one of the last humps, there's hardly a month where you don't have an Aliens book. And if you look at this time period, there were months where they barely had a Dark Horse book. There were months where they either didn't have anything or they only have one or two titles. And then by the time you get to this Earth War period, they're just expanding. I'm looking for references on Amazing Heroes. Amazing Heroes, you know, evolves coverage. They have, you know, their news section, and it was a bi-weekly, if I recall correctly. And so they'd have a news section where they do these little blurbs about publishers. Most of the publishers were alphabetized in the back end of the news section. And then you see steadily over the months, Dark Horse goes from those blurbs in the back to having their own section toward this period, they would have like a whole page sometimes of just the Dark Horse news section. And it really is, I think, the house that Aliens built. And obviously Predator helped to put in a wing, and the Terminator probably helped put in a wing. But ultimately, Aliens was there from the beginning. Aliens was there until they took it away from Dark Horse. And you just don't have a Dark Horse or eventually Dark Horse Films without that success of Aliens. Something that Dark Horse did with its property and the other properties that they licensed, they did it really, really right and somehow made these licenses matter in a way other publishers never could. you can't give Dark Horse enough credit for what they managed to do. But I also think there's some fruit of a poisonous tree creatively. Because when I look back at the first Aliens, I did enjoy that miniseries when I finally read it. Part of what I like about it is, what does they call it? The early season weirdness or something?
Early installment weirdness.
Thank you. Yeah. The fact that they're trying to throw so much shit at the wall, and there's so many different directions and so many different ideas and influences. I can't say for certain, but I feel like, of all things, I think Life Force had to have had an influence on that first miniseries, because it does a very similar thing where they focus you on this mystery. They focus you on the teams going to Acheron to go get an alien specimen, and the other team is going to try to poach the specimen from them. And they spend like 4 or 5 issues on that, and then all of a sudden at the end of the miniseries, it's like, oh, by the way, did we mention Earth is fucked and you guys have fully missed it and everything's going crazy? It's like Life Force. You think that you're chasing after the space vampire and you're doing that for 3/4 of the movie, and then you get back to London, fucking zombie pandemic and shit. The church is full of bodies and they're sending all the soul power up to the stars to be collected in their fucking spaceship and shit. You've been so busy with this other story, you've been missing the real shit that's happening. And I understand that was Mike Richardson's idea. Was he told Verhaeden it has to end on Earth with the alien infestation? And I think the idea was, you had so many licenses. I'm thinking about High Fidelity, Jack Black, Pussy. They were just fucking safe. They were coloring within the margins. And I think that probably the most brilliant thing that Richardson and company did was blow up the formula, raise the stakes enormously. It would have been so easy to just, okay, well, here's another outbreak on this other colony. You know, here's a little side adventure with Ripley, and maybe separate them so Hicks and Newt are having this adventure and Ripley's having this adventure. They could have played that shit out forever, spinning wheels, and it would have been very much like Marvel Star Wars adaptations, where it was just, how can we fill the space in between the sequels until they finish their story? How do we fill up this space until they tell us where the story's going to go from here? And Dark Horse wisely said, fuck it, we're jumping it like 10 years in the future, and we're doing whatever the fuck we feel like. And I think it showed people that you could do something with franchises that was rock and roll. It's a comic book. Who gives a shit? Nobody's spending millions of dollars on this stuff. The old saw they always tell you about, where comic books don't have a budget. You know, you can do whatever the fuck you want to. You can blow up the earth and rebuild it again, and all it costs you is the paper and ink. And I think they got that. And they swung for the fences. But at the same time, I had my issues with the second part of the trilogy, and that's not uncommon. The third part, you finally know that this is the full scope of the story. This is the full arc of the characters as intended by the writer. And I think it's just painfully clear that there wasn't a game plan. And that once they got past that first miniseries, acting as though that this was the only comic book they were ever going to publish, and then it's a success. And I think there's just a real sense of, oh shit, now what do we do? And I think it's pretty clear by the arc of the story. What are your thoughts on the arc of the trilogy, and particularly the closing chapters?
To me, it feels like you're describing Lost. You thought all this setup in the first part of the trilogy had all these opportunities. I don't know that I was so focused on that. Imagine if I was the person that not only loved Lost, but loved all the shitty last seasons that people hated, and only saw those shitty last seasons or something. Like, that's kind of where my little kid head probably comes into it. Part of it is, you have to deliver. You can pull the Geoff Johns thing at the end of book two and be like, ta-da, Ripley. Like, that was your trick. You pulled her out of the hat, but now what are you going to do with her? I think there's moments. I kind of like the ideas that were put in this Earth War, where if Aliens, the film, turned Alien up to 11 in every sense of the word, it was a true sequel, arguably superior sequel, or at the very least, a sequel that escalated the conditions of the first movie, just purely factually, where you don't have to get into that argument of which film is better, Alien or Aliens. I guess I bought into the branding, the whole Earth War. Oh shit, this stuff is on Earth and it's super serious, with the first miniseries that buries the lead. But since I guess I hadn't exactly read the first miniseries, and even though things were hinted at in book two, I always felt like this, because it was titled Earth War, they were going to war for the planet and that Ripley was involved in the story. For some reason, that always felt that it added a air of legitimacy to it for me. There is that sense of escalation in this, at least Ripley's gonna give everybody power loaders. We've learned from the last film, and why not arm yourself? You have a commando team and you're gonna go bust heads with aliens. It's like everybody should have power loaders, and that she's got this plan. I like that moment where, like, she's the general and she's giving orders to everybody. Even though there are some people that are not 100% aboard with the program, she was the one who comes up with this plan. She's going after the Patient Zero alien queen. That's how they try to spin it. There's a queen, the original all-seeing, all-knowing, all-telepathy queen. Ripley's going after that queen and going to use it to destroy the entire species. How it ultimately plays out is weird, because they make these allusions to the engineers and stuff like that, and that seems like an afterthought, but then it's played as they were masterminding everything from behind the scenes, but yet they're not really involved in the story. So, like, that was weird for me to look at with new eyes. You know, even though it has nothing to do with Prometheus, there's that aspect. I don't know, like to me, there's less of that uncomfortability in the second miniseries that you were talking about. This is, I guess, a little more straightforward, a little more meat and potatoes, I suppose. I guess you just have to buy into the premise. It's like, these aliens are even nastier. They're even able to eat through the power loaders and that whole kind of vibe. For Newt, she still has that arc with the little girl going in the background. Once you introduce Ripley, once you bring back that big Geoff Johns Golden Age character, does that Golden Age character then overshadow all the characters you've been building up in this other miniseries? Hicks takes a pretty big backseat in this, so if you were expecting him to do something awesome, I don't know that that necessarily happens.
Last thing I remember is going into hypersleep after losing my entire unit and escaping a planet overrun with monsters straight out of your worst nightmares. Now I wake up to your smiling face, armed men trying to kill me in one of those things wrapped around her face.
Look, I'm sorry for your loss. I really am. But we're tethered to a boat crawling with those things as part of some corporate experiment gone bad. And they don't look to be wanting any outside eyes peering in. They're heavily armed and don't seem to have any issue killing anyone in their way. If we don't get word out, they're gonna bury this thing and all of us with it.
Excerpt from Steve Perry's introduction to the 1996 Aliens Nightmare Asylum trade paperback titled Hanging Out at the Comic Store. My son was a serious comic book collector when he was 13, and I used to take him to Pegasus Comics in Beaverton, Oregon, to pick up the titles in his box and to scan the racks. Sometimes the guy behind the counter was a very tall, smiling guy named Mike Richardson. While my son shopped, Mike and I would sometimes talk. Turned out he was the owner of the store. I told him I was a writer, and of course he was also a writer, though he hadn't really gotten into it seriously yet. We had some interesting conversations. He was a nice guy. It was a pleasant way to pass the time while my son spent his allowance. Fast forward a few years. My son has grown and off at college, and Mike Richardson is now the president of some little comic book outfit called Dark Horse. One day the phone rings, and it's Mike. He has, he says, gotten the rights to do novelizations of his Alien series, and would have been interested in maybe writing one. Not a graphic novel, but a book. Well, the upfront money wasn't as good as what I was getting for my own stuff, and the royalties would have to be divided up among several folks, Dark Horse, Fox, and eventually Bantam. But Mike was pretty sure that it'd sell well. He's good at that, figuring out what will sell well. The idea of putting the character Ripley through her paces was appealing. I liked Mike and the idea of working with him. If he can't have fun, why bother? I had the graphic novel from which to work, although we'd have to alter some names because the script for the third Aliens movie got changed a whole lot from when it was used as the basis for the graphic novel. I must point out that the third Aliens movie was not my favorite of the series. I like Jim Cameron's Aliens best, and I think that had they used the first graphic novel as the basis for Alien 3, the movie would have been, 1,000 times better than it was. That's my opinion. Mike and I had lunch, his treat. We hashed out some ideas. A deal was struck. I hurried, turned it in, and everybody seemed pretty happy with the book. Mike liked it, his agent liked it, Bantam liked it. Enough so, they offered me another one, and another one after that, and then another one, and then even an Aliens vs. Predator. This was turning into a pretty lucrative deal. I also had other work, so my daughter, Danielle Perry, who was a fledgling writer at the time, agreed to help. To give credit where it is due, she wrote most of the third novelization, The Female War, virtually all of Aliens vs. Predator, Prey, and went on to write another Aliens novelization, Labyrinth, as well as a couple of other books, Chip Off the Old Block. These books have all done very well indeed. They've been translated into several foreign languages, gone back for multiple printings in this country and in Great Britain, sold hundreds of thousands of copies all over the world, and generally made everybody connected with them happy. Did I mention that Mike Richardson is good at figuring out what will sell well? Perry went on to talk about doing the novelization for The Mask and how all this led into his doing the book for Star Wars Shadows of the Empire, which in turn got me 5 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list, a visit to Skywalker Ranch, a consulting credit on the Shadows comic book series, a trip to sign autographs at Disneyland, and a chance to work with top flight folks at Dark Horse, Lucasfilm, and Bantam, and probably some nice royalties down the line too. Man, oh man, did I get lucky or what? So next time somebody rags you about wasting your time reading trashy comics or hanging out at the comic book store, you have my permission to tell them my story if you want. You just never know where things will lead you.
Is this still, like, not your Hicks and Newt? Is this not your Ripley? Fucking Billy and, I don't know, I can't even remember, Glute and Glicks? You know, I get that they're not the same when they rename them, but do they rename Ripley? Like, is Ripley somebody else in this?
This is the story where we get the three leads from Aliens, and I guess of the three, the only one that bears a resemblance to their former self is Hicks because of the scarring. They just barely get off Acheron, and then there's another company man who's kind of like a Burke type who catches their ship, wakes up Ripley, says, do this mission for me, I need you, and if you don't do it, then I'll make one of the other people do it for you. Maybe we'll make the little girl go on the mission, you know, that kind of bullshit. She goes on the mission, you get the reset where most of the guys that suck got killed, but then she gets the psychic download from the engineer pilot, whatever, where she sees a star chart, so she knows where to find more of the aliens, and because she's too valuable to the company, she has to disappear and abandon Newt. Okay, but they never came up with another dude who does do exactly what that guy threatened to do, where, well, we're going to take Hicks to someplace. They never take him back to Acheron. Why'd they wait for all these years to go back? They know that that's there. You know, they've already discussed that some of the aliens survived, and that's what Ripley was going back to do, so there's no reason why they couldn't have done that with Hicks. Or they could have done it with Newt. Ripley's so valuable, why aren't we seeing her adventures when she's going out and taking out the aliens? Why does she need to wait until she hooks back up with Newt and Hicks to go on that mission to go get the queen? What is this fucking nonsense anyway? All this complicated shit where the telepathy to find the queen, to draw, it's all this fucking convoluted bullshit. It doesn't make story sense, and it's a self-inflicted wound because you wouldn't have had to do all this shit if you hadn't done a time jump in the first fucking place. And having done that, then you need to come up with something a little bit more convincing for why these characters didn't interact sooner. I think I get why Dark Horse just kind of drop it, because I know at this point that they don't do anything else with Ripley except for stuff tied into the movie adaptations. They drop Billy and Wicks or whatever the fuck. We don't see these guys again, to my knowledge. I think there's an element of just like do-over. They realize that they painted themselves into a corner, and it's like, we're just going to stop and we're going to do a new miniseries, and we'll get some talented people on here, and we'll tell a story that's maybe a little bit more in line with what you'd expect from Alien stuff. You know, this is just the end. But what's weird to me is all this fucking bullshit that's in these miniseries, but they're successful and they make a ton of money, and so they fucking adapt this shit into novels, and they make whole novels after these weird ass fucking miniseries. They have to expand this to novel length, and they're doing it after Alien 3. So my understanding is by the time you get to the book version of this miniseries, Ripley's actually an android that's been implanted with memories that they were able to gather from Ripley after she died, and so they send her out on these missions, and it's just like, shut up, just stop talking, just shut the fuck, like, how do you turn this into a book?
So wait, so the Gluten Glicks version of Ripley, is they just retcon her to be an android?
Right.
Okay.
And that's why, so at least they don't have to explain why these people weren't connecting, because, well, she wasn't really around. She'd obviously died in the movies, and so now she's an android hanging out with Gluten Glick, you know? And I guess to make sure to capture the authentic voice, Steve Perry wrote it with his daughter, Stephanie, even though you got fake Newt and robot Ripley. It's just like, what the fuck?
And he would like to know if you ever read any of the Perry adaptations of your comics, and if so, what did you think of them?
No. Simple answer. And I didn't read read the Predator ones either, which were by someone else. Yeah, I think that's great that they did those. It's funny, the only thing that's interesting is to read reviews of that, comparing it to the book, because sometimes it's like, now I'm getting confused. What was in which, you know? So, but that's just me. No, I haven't read them. I was kind of stunned, to tell you the truth, that my comic book was being adapted into novels. That was at the time. I was kind of like, they're doing what? I don't recall ever meeting or talking to him. Not of a mind to like tell someone else how they should write something. If they want to ask me, I can give them my thoughts, but take it, do with it, go with God. At the time, my thought was, if there's a way to keep these in print into some semblance of what they were, that's great, because I'm really proud of the work of them. But the truth is, I think we've gotten to a point now where fans are sophisticated enough to know that this was a thing that spun off of the second film. The third film changed that. Just like there's 50 different versions of Batman over the years, I think there can be different versions of the alien canon that exist in their own little offshoot world, and you can accept them from what they are or not. Let me put it this way. I wasn't thrilled with the idea of changing the names, because I thought the connection of Newt and Hicks to the original films was was really strong. On the other hand, I understand why they did it, but I had nothing to do with the editorial process in evolving them. I just stayed away from that. Again, was happy that they were still in print in some form, and that kept them alive, but I'm glad that the originals are back.
Before shooting started, they actually made them run around with their guns under their arm and train, and they used to let me run along with them, and I'd have my doll, my Cabbage Patch Kid, underneath my arm running with them and everything. So I never felt like I didn't belong with them. It was really nice.
The December 1991 cover dated Comic Scene number 23 featured, among other things, an interview with Sometimes Rollspine podcast listener Sean McLaughlin discussing his work on the Aquaman series. More relevant to this particular podcast was a Sam Keith interview. Quote, "In an industry driven as much by super egos as superheroes, talent and humility are hard to find in one package. Comic book artist Sam Keith is a refreshing combination of both. Still in shock that he can do what he loves for a living, the self-deprecating Keith entered comics when I learned the world didn't need another mediocre guitarist. It was either this or Burger King. Happily, the artist drew Aliens Earth War instead of flipping Whoppers or bagging fries. The third installment of Dark Horse Comics' best-selling Alien series put me on the map. If I am on the map," he laughs. "I was talking to publisher Mike Richardson at Dark Horse, and he was very enthusiastic in suggesting, if I had any houses I wanted to buy, that an Aliens miniseries might do the job. I didn't believe him, but it was the truth. To capture the look of the blockbuster films, he used them as reference. Oh man, I hate those movies," he moans. "I had to look at those movies so many times and freeze frame them. I can never look at an Aliens movie again. The first Alien is ruined for me. Somebody stole my VCR and the Alien cassette inside it, and I didn't even care. While the miniseries was a direct sequel to the films, Sigourney Weaver wasn't, in my version, and couldn't be," Keith reveals. "Legally, 20th Century Fox would have had to pay Sigourney Weaver to use her likeness in the third series. So in the first two series, people were clamoring for Ripley to come back, and there was an expectation that she would look like Sigourney Weaver. Dark Horse told me specifically, we don't want to pay Sigourney Weaver a bunch of money. We can't afford to. We're not interested, so don't do it. Draw her to look like anything but a middle-aged woman. I didn't even achieve that," he laughs. "She barely looked female with me drawing it." Keith's approach to the creatures drew more from the Vault of Horror than Ridley Scott. "Aliens was just a monster book like Sandman, so I tried to do something different. People were alarmed that I was trying to make their aliens look like an EC comic. They kept telling me it wasn't appropriate and that it should look like the movie, not an EC comic. Fans were amazed that I tried to be realistic and cartoony in the same story. I treated the whole thing as a black and white comic, almost as if it'd be better served being published in black and white. In the beginning, my favorite part of doing the book was drawing the aliens themselves. Towards the end, it was the women," he remarks. "The focus shifted, which meant I had fewer aliens visual art pages to sell to dealers and lots of pages of women nobody wanted to buy." Keith found dealing with 20th Century Fox to be far more terrifying than the aliens. "Working with Dark Horse is great, but 20th Century Fox is much less lenient. They tend to make changes without consulting anybody. And when they decide something's going to happen, it's going to happen. It was like working for DuPont or or any other corporation. You don't have any control over what happens. The people at Dark Horse were nice about being between Fox and the artist. The artist shudders in mock anguish at some of Fox's antics. They made odd changes. They shaved off all the women's hips, making them look top-heavy. He laughs in disbelief. If you're going to shave off the hips, let's take the breasts too, so I don't look breast-infatuated. Our editor, Diana Schultz, tried to argue with them endlessly about it, but they had their own ideas. His feelings on Aliens Earth War are mixed. I liked it because I liked drawing a gooey monster. When the series was most like the movies, it reminded me that, in some small way, I was involved with the movies. It was fun to design a new alien for the comic, and that John Bolton helped design what I drew. It was fun overall, but we could have done such a better job if there had been certain things. More time, the system, he adds. I'm not blaming anybody, but Kelly Jones is doing a new Alien series, and it looks like he's going to have the time and preparation necessary to make it look nice. In the meantime, Keith has cut loose on his new Wolverine Bloodhungry miniseries for Marvel Comics Presents. I basically feel that the difference between doing something like Wolverine and Aliens is that the fans of Aliens are movie fans who happen to read comics. If I get in the way of their version of the movie, then I better get out of their way. When I'm working on Wolverine, I'm not worried if I'm cartoony or realistic, and Marvel hasn't made any predispositions. Excerpt from Sam's blog, dated Thursday, March 15th, 2012, titled Of Aliens, Sequels, and Teddy Bears. The first time I drew Aliens many years ago, it was a mixed bag. Other than the first Aliens issue I drew, which I liked, the last three issues were very rushed and pretty bad work on my part. Trust me, the color hid tons of rushed lame art. Dark Horse got 300 pieces of fan letters from the first series I drew. Unfortunately, only three letters liked it. Kelly Jones found out the same thing when he drew an Aliens book too. It seems whoever drew a new miniseries was compared to the previous artists, and fans threw tomatoes at you for not looking like the previous Aliens artists. But like Kelly, it taught me to develop a thick skin early on. Fans bought it anyway, and in retrospect, nobody seems to mind all the flaws, or remember the flap over it.
I'm not sure who could follow up Denny Bouvet. I remember that sort of being a question that was so strong. And, you know, look, Sam, who's a very nice guy and very talented, he was actually quite hot, too, at the time. I think he was working for Marvel back then, off and on, or maybe it was after. Anyway, he'd done a lot of interesting work. He just brought a totally different style. I respect that some don't care for it. It was the best choice at the time. You know, I hope Sam is still proud of what he did. I'm proud of what he did on the book. Is it as successful as the other two? I don't know. And so I'm not going to blindly say that everyone's wrong. I think there's strengths in some of what he did. He draws a great alien. And but maybe after Bouvet and after Mark Nelson, it was hard to think of anyone who could have stepped into that role, you know, not had a little bit of pushback, unless we'd gotten Denny to do another one or brought back Mark Nelson. It's a long way to say. I you know, there's parts of it I like. I tend to take the blame myself. Maybe I didn't give him as good of a story either, for whatever reason. Certainly I'm aware that the third one isn't as well-loved as the other two. However, I think it has some strengths as well. So I'll leave it there.
For me, the highlight of this, I really love all the Sam Keith art.
The main selling point to this for me, why it stands out to me. Even though I know he had a career before this, I feel like this and the Marvel Comics Presents stuff was my first exposure. I'd lean heavy into the art.
When I come back to this, that's the main reason why I remember it as fondly as I did. And then there was the hullabaloo about picking Sam Keith because they knew he wasn't going to do likenesses. That aspect where they were going to have to pay people for their likenesses, but as long as they made the miniseries where it didn't look like Sigourney Weaver, that everybody was cool with it. You have this aspect where you're dealing with a Ripley that maybe is not spitting image, this painterly, photorealistic recreation. It's just kind of a comic book interpretation of a character that could be Ellen Ripley, but if you just looked at it without context and dialogue, it's not necessarily something to tip off people, where Sigourney Weaver's going to call her lawyers.
Not only is Newt almost a grown woman, but there's a lot of male gaze in this one. And so if I was uncomfortable with a lot of the sexualization of Newt that was very explicit in the second miniseries, in the third miniseries, there was no sexual situations. There's no reason for her to be shown in that light, except that Sam Keith just can't stop drawing her with pendulous breasts and a firm rump and having her make sure to contort her body to show that off as much she can. And same goes for Ripley. It's the ick factor.
Maybe I could see that in the one Marine lady or whatever. I guess if I overly examined it, I could see some of it. I always took Sam Keith as being, not that the women weren't sexy, but I never felt like they were blow-up dolls. They may have curves, and you may see the male gaze on their female forms. I never felt like there was anything plastic there.
I think there's a very clear, strong Frank Frazetta influence on Keith's artwork. And clearly, he liked Frazetta women. They were not heroin chic. They were not Jim Lee, hipless, supermodel-type women. But they were definitely conventionally attractive. And one thing that's nice about Sam Keith as his career progresses is he does feature a lot more variety of female body types and a much greater allowance for different types of women to also be attractive or just not be attractive. When you're looking at, say, The Max, or you're looking at the series he did after The Max ended, much more realistic looking women. Where here, though, pretty much all the women, again, very Frazetta, their clothes fit them so tightly. You look at Ripley in the first two movies, and she's wearing essentially overalls, the kind of shit you'd wear if you were working at a plant. The only time you really get to see Ripley in a sexual light, or really any of the women in a sexual light, setting aside the Colonial Marines, is when she's stripping down in the first movie. You do have, like, Vasquez, for instance, she's wearing a tank top, and so you do have opportunities to see a lot more of her curves, but of course Vasquez is not being played as a sexualized being. She's just like, hey, I'm going to get hot carrying around this smart gun that I'm going to be fucking blowing people's heads off with, so I don't have time to worry about whether or not I'm wearing a bra or not. You're not really thinking about I'm not thinking about how sexy Vasquez is because she's just in a tank top. I'm thinking about how much ass she's kicking. Where with this miniseries, there's a lot of people standing around talking about the plan and, oh, we're going to get in our ship and we're going to fly to this place and that kind of shit. And so there's a lot of time for them to kind of lean up against surfaces and for their little buttocks to sway and shit. So definitely there's a fair amount of that in here.
His heart rate has dropped way below a critical threshold.
I don't think my safety's a top priority.
The loss of the Legato was unfortunate. So many specimens.
There were families aboard that ship.
I said it was unfortunate.
It's only unfortunate that you lost your specimens.
On the contrary, lucky for you, some managed to escape. Didn't they?
In my case, I think I only saw one issue of Earth War, and I didn't see it until after the fact, like a year or two after the fact. And so I think I'd already been exposed to Keith through his Marvel Comics Presents work. And I think I knew him by name by that point, but I can't guarantee it. He might have just been the dude who did the cool looking covers that I had a vague awareness of. Flipping through the whatever one issue of the four that I got my hands on, liking the artwork, thinking it was very attractive, thinking that it was flashy in a way that you don't get to see in this type of property very often. And I think the one thing that Dark Horse was definitely doing in their early miniseries was that quality of prestige and trying to reach out to some artists that were either name brand or could give you an elevated experience. A few series down the line, they get more of their guys. Like the first Predator miniseries, I think Chris Warner does, and that was already one of their guys who'd done Black Cross and was working on Dark Horse Presents. And I think as things progress, they get more comfortable using their own people and they can get more consistent work out of them without the huge gaps. But I think that there was that attempt to give you that elevated experience with the first miniseries. And I do think Sam Keith provides that because it's, you know, this guy becomes one of the big image artists. He was like that next tier of guys who were coming up that Marvel could bring to the fore. But he was definitely a contender. And the fact that they had what would become an image contender on a Dark Horse licensed book definitely has an impact. But at the same time, I look at Ripley and she's drawn in such a way she looks like she's Victorian. You know, she looks like she could be in like a Jane Austen adaptation. And in no way resembles Sigourney Weaver, and I get that we're avoiding likenesses, but she's so soft. It looks like she should be captaining the Voyager in the early season. When she does finally get involved with some action, I don't think that the character design sells that, and I really need Ripley to look like Ripley and act like Ripley. And it's a problem I've had throughout these miniseries. I don't feel like these characters are in character for most of it. Ripley especially, with all this insane contrived plotting that goes into the whole reaction to the Earth War, I don't recognize the characters. I don't care if they change the names or not. Newt, Billy, Wicks, Hicks, these aren't the characters from the movies for me, so it feels like it's a 18-issue what if. None of this feels like it fits in any kind of continuity, and I don't think the characters are acting in character. They don't look like themselves. There's too much goofy shit where I don't connect to it. I don't see the aliens in this. The later miniseries are a victim of the crazy chances they took in the first miniseries. It almost becomes becomes like fan fiction because they introduce the concept, for instance, of the telepathy and how the alien queen is guiding her soldiers through telepathy and how humans are susceptible to this telepathy. And that's kind of a novel idea in the first Mooney series. But by the time you get to the third one, they have these human slaves, these guys drawn like they're zombies or rednecks from a Hills Have Eyes kind of movie. You've got these humans running around acting like drones, but they talk and they chide and they're sarcastic. And then you actually have the drones running around as well. Again, it reminds me too much of Life Force. Everybody has a psychic connection to the Mother Queen. And that's where, you know, why Billy wants to go to her and Ripley wants to go to her, because they have all these psychic connections and they can't break free. And it all becomes about telepathy. It's like, okay, so we're going to find the Mother Queen and we're going to steal her from the home planet and we're going to take her to Earth. And that's going to draw all the aliens in one place. And then we're going to nuke all the aliens in the one place. And then we're going to fuck off because we don't actually care about Earth. We just care about killing all the aliens. It just gets to be too big and too ridiculous. Why is there all this telepathy? Why are there enslaved humans running around? How is it that we've gone through three miniseries with Amy and suddenly he's not Uncle Bert, now he's Daddy again, or Ben? They're not even consistent with their weird little retcons and shit, but it's like, I still don't care about Amy. I've been following the Amy arc for three miniseries. Save her, don't save her. I don't really give a fuck. It doesn't matter. They introduce these new, not Colonial Marines. I can tell you there's the black chick and there's the balding guy with the mustache. And those are the, and there's the chicken shit pilot. You want me to ask me the names? I don't know the fucking names. You want me to tell you their personalities? The old guy is a little bit lecherous, but not so much that it's all that interesting. Pilot guy's a chicken shit. He talks a little bit of shit. I think the black chick talks a little shit too, but only in like one scene. That's it. Nobody here is competing for my affections with the pre-existing characters. Ultimately, it looks like they blow up the Earth, I think, is what happens. Why did you need to gather all the aliens into one place so you can nuke the Earth if all you're going to do is nuke the Earth and fly away anyway? Maybe they only nuked part of the Earth? Why would the Queen Mother bring all the aliens to one place in the first place? Because they're playing with her being super smart and knowing what's going on. So why would she do exactly what Ripley wants them to do? And I know they do the whole thing at the end where it's the big question mark, where you see her rising out of the ashes of the nuclear holocaust. And don't even get me started on they go to, I guess, what's supposed to be the alien homeworld. And you have the pod things where the super aliens come out and they're superhumanly strong and they can rip the power loaders to pieces like nothing. This reminds me of the Shane Black, the Predator movie, where we don't just have a Predator, we have a super Predator now. And now he can rip through the fucking ships and stuff. You're not giving me anything new. You're just taking the thing that was already there, amping it up, you're putting it on steroids, which is classic sequel fuck up. Part of what makes Alien such a brilliant sequel is that they continue the premise of these xenomorph killing machines that reproduce in this horrifying fashion, fanning it out exponentially. You had an alien in one, now you have aliens in the other, and they do introduce the queen and they do give you more of that sense of the insect society. They expand upon what was in the first movie, but mostly it's just, this is the same concept, but there's more of them. And that's where a lot of sequels stop. But they also go, okay, and now we're not doing a horror movie, the haunted house thing, like you mentioned in the last episode. We're doing the action movie, and we've got this force that's supposed to be able to take on the aliens. But just because we have guns doesn't mean we can handle these creatures because they're smarter than us. And they're coming up with interesting ways for the aliens to circumvent the superior power. And of course, they kneecap them early on by taking away most of their weapons and tearing down their numbers and everything else. I think the important thing is that Alien told a great story, and then Aliens told a great story. And I don't think that, while it's great that you have more aliens, you know, you go do the behind the scenes shit and you realize they only had like four or five suits. So there really aren't that many more aliens. They just make you feel like you have a lot more because of tricks of the camera, but mostly it's kind of the storytelling. This oppressive sense of these large numbers coming in, the siege mentality. In Alien, it is very much like a Michael Myers situation where you've just got this one thing, and we can find this one thing that's moving around inside of our house. We could kill that thing and we can move on with our lives. Where Aliens is more like a zombie movie or more like a Western where their natives are coming to storm the fort. We don't understand the culture and they're coming up with shit that we're not seeing coming. It's telling a different story with the same basic principles. You find a new twist. You find a new way of telling a story about these creatures, something novel, something interesting. You don't just go, okay, well, now we're doing the super aliens. And now we're doing the Mother Queen, who's like the much more powerful and much smarter than the queen from the last one. It doesn't feel like it's grounded within the universe. I think that they've been coloring outside the margins so long that it's all just become this squiggle. I just can't connect to any of it. It's a mess to me. Because I've never connected to the characters, and because the majority of the story is told in that first miniseries, and it just feels like it's sputtering off of the fumes in the latter two miniseries, it just seems really pointless to me. And I'm glad that they finally decided to retire the story arc and retire hire the creative teams, but it's frustrating to me because this is the Ripley story. I love the character of Ripley. I would love to see her have more adventures. It's like you were talking about in the previous episodes where, like, at least Hicks and Newt are alive, but I don't see Hicks and Newt. I just see these assholes. Hicks decides he doesn't want to deal with the aliens, so he runs off, and that lasts for like a page, and he's right back again, and all he ultimately does is help to fly the ship, and he doesn't really interact meaningfully with anything. I mean, he's with the party, and he's helping to lead the party, but he could just be another asshole. He could just be another one of these broke-ass colonial marines they got. I don't feel Hicks. I don't feel that personality. I don't feel that. It just feels like going through the motion. I like looking at the artwork. It's pretty. I do think there's a bit of an issue, though, where I love the technique that he's using, but because he has that idiosyncratic way of drawing shit, a lot of times things that should be scary or like at moments of brutal violence just seem goofy. Sometimes that feels like I'm reading the mad parody of the Aliens comic book miniseries as opposed to the actual thing.
Well, I mean, it sounds like you have a problem with the premise, or at least a problem with how the original miniseries spiraled out into these hackneyed, tired premises. I mean, I don't know if I'm putting words in your mouth, but you kind of have to be willing to suspend disbelief and go along with certain aspects to put yourself in a frame of enjoyment. If you can't do that, then this just becomes something where it's like there are emotions that are gone through, and there are these things that are trying to approximate the characters that you are familiar with and love from the films, but they come up short.
Right. I just don't feel like a lot of the stuff that was set up was ever resolved, or a lot of the way that it was resolved was very hand wavy. And there was some like heavier themes that could have been continued on, but they just decided to do a big action blow up. And I do wonder if there wasn't some management stuff there. It almost like reading through this miniseries, especially the latter two, there's a kind of a Dio vibe where I feel like maybe the fucking editors or the management was getting involved with shit and trying to pull things back from weird ledges that they got into, particularly in the last miniseries. I didn't hate it. It's fine, but I don't connect to it, and I don't feel like this is the Aliens that I signed up for. Before we started talking, I watched another 10 to 15 minutes of the Peter Jackson King Kong, and I've never watched the thing all the way through, because what ends up happening is I watch those 10 minutes and I reach a point where I'm just like, why is this? Like, I'm not even judging the movie on its own merits. It's just like, why did you think that we needed to watch Naomi Watts climb every fucking rung of every ladder on the fucking Empire State Building to get to the top so that she could stare longingly again at fucking King Kong? Or the sequence where they're like, they're on the ice and he's like, you know, why? Why is this? Why is this so long? Why is this so involved? Why are you doing this period piece 100 years after the fucking original, which is a better movie that moves a lot fucking faster? Why is this? Why is this here? Why is this in front of me? Why were millions and millions of dollars devoted to making another King Kong movie when every single time they remade King Kong, it's fucking sucked? I saw the fucking King Kong in the 70s. It sucked. I saw the King Kong in the 80s. It sucked. Why do you keep making these fucking King Kong movies? And then finally they did Skull Island, and it was like, okay, because now we can do the shit that you couldn't do back in the day, and we're going to tell a new story in part because we're taking advantage of the public domain aspect where we don't want to do anything from the other movies because of copyright issues, so we're just going to take the idea of giant gorilla that fights dinosaurs and shit and just go nuts with that. And that's the shit that works. That's the good one, because they got to the core of the appeal and they just did that cool shit. I'm on an island with dinosaurs and I'm fighting them, and there's some soldiers and shit. They're the people you're connected to. They're your point of view characters, but really we're all here to see King Kong fuck up dinosaurs. That's what you're there for. You're not there for ice skating and Naomi Watts and fucking Adrian Brody and shit. And it's the same thing I'm having with these miniseries. It's like, I would be able to be on board. I would buy in so much easier if it wasn't Ripley and company. If these were just some new characters, I'd be like, fuck it. Okay. Let them have their fucking fun. It doesn't fucking matter. I think I just resent so much that they're taking these characters that I want to see more adventures of. I love these characters. I want to see them do more stuff just like you. At least they're alive. At least they can do stuff in these comic books. But if I don't fucking recognize the characters and doing all kinds of wackadoo stupid shit, I'm just thwarted. I'm here for you. I'm a fan of this material. I'm a fan of these characters. Just color the line. I think that as the Dark Horse miniseries progress, they do start to realize that let's make sure we're within the scope of the Aliens lore. Let's make sure that we're telling stories that are appropriate to this type of material. And sometimes it'll be more action oriented. Sometimes it'll be more horror oriented. Sometimes they'll have stronger science fiction hooks to them. But let's not just go fucking gonzo. And again, I shouldn't be reading these Aliens miniseries and thinking about Life Force, which is another movie. I love Life Force. And that's a gonzo fucking weird ass movie. but it's not Alien. If I wanted the Life Force book, somebody needs to publish that someday. It'd probably have to be Eros. And if you want to do weird shit with that, go ahead. Because everything about Life Force is weird shit. I expect it from you. I don't expect it from Aliens, because part of what makes Aliens so great is that it's realistic. It's grounded. It's a fucking oil refinery in space. It's a fucking company of Marines. I know what soldiers are like, and I know that these soldiers are going into a Vietnam parallel where they're going to get ripped to fucking pieces because they've got all the best artillery and all the fucking best weapons and vehicles, and they just don't know that they're walking into a fucking meat grinder because they don't understand the kind of combat they're entering, in part because it's not even combat. They're fawns and they're going up against jungle cats. My life experiences are made more fantastical, but I still can see my life and the lives of people I know within those films. And the more you get wackadoo gonzo, which is the problem I have with Resurrection as well, the more I check out, the more I feel like you don't get the material. And yeah, actually that's true of most of the sequels. I think Ridley Scott climbed up his fucking asshole with all that fucking philosophical shit in fucking Prometheus. And I don't care about fingering the fucking polyps in this guy's intestine, you know? It's like, this isn't what I'm here for, man. I don't want to start a series of podcasts on a bad note. I'm glad that I looked at the other adaptations and stuff before that, so I can just like vent my frustration at these miniseries and hopefully be able to move forward and be happier with what's to come.
There's not going to be that same tie to the previous characters. And, you know, I don't know if you're my spirit animal or not, but I can tell you that I never watched the Peter Jackson King Kong. After I saw the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake, I basically swore off all remake. The only thing I know about the Peter Jackson King Kong was that video game was fun as fuck, and everything else, I've never seen it. I love Life Force 2, to use some fanholes vernacular, my own vernacular. It sounds like you're saying to me that Earth War got a little too blue cupcakey, that it just got Grant Morrison-y, like weird for weird's sake, and went to all these strange places, but there wasn't anything really tenuous holding it, and you don't feel like there's any viable explanations for it. Whether the Super Queen and the Super Aliens are tired and hackney, maybe at bare minimum, if you had seen some kind of reasonable explanation for there to be a Super Queen and a Super Alien and Super Telepathy and Super whatever, right? Then maybe you could suspend disbelief enough. But I will admit, they shrouded in mystery. They didn't have much of a plan, kind of like the Lost guys. So like when you finally get to it, it's weird reading it because it's almost like the space jockey guy taking over Earth is like an afterthought. All I can defend and be happy and positive about is, for me, I do like the art, whether they're male gazy, sexy, baggy pants, whatever chicks, or to me, like I'd say that Prometheus ship that they stumble upon in this is sexy as fuck too. I don't know what the deal is, but that little ring log ship, the juggernaut, whatever the hell they're calling it these days, the shots of those look super cool to me. I kind of get what you're saying, that there's that Mad Magazine vibe to it, but I guess I don't think I ever went there. I guess I had weird flashes where, no, I can't tell you any of the other characters' names, but I can't tell you any of the characters' names in The Walking Dead either, barely. But I feel like some of these characters remind me of, see, I'm getting flashbacks, but it's like the one chick that's the not Colonial Marine chick. It's like, what are their names? Rosita and whatever it is in The Walking Dead. Like, I feel like it's like, I feel like they're precursors to those characters, right? The guy with the big handlebar mustache is like the same shit, right? Like Rosita and whatever the fuck that guy's name is. But anyway, that's some things I was thinking of in retrospect. I was looking at the character designs for those guys. You're not super happy with the premise. You don't recognize these as the characters. What if the characters you recognized were in this shitastic, blue cupcakey, weird premise? Like, is there anything that the real Ripley and the real Newton Hicks would be doing in this wacky doodle thing that would have spoken to you as true Ripleyism, or there's just no hope for this thing?
The plot is pretty horrible. So it's like, yeah, I think that I might have actually been even more angry and more frustrated if I recognized the characters, but the fact that they just go so far off the rails, I can divorce them from all all of this. I wouldn't say that it's the Grant Morrison qualities, because I think that that's more in place that first miniseries. I think when there's just all this weird shit going on and you don't know where it's all going to end up going and stuff, that's much more interesting. It's just that they shot their load in that first miniseries, and then, you know, there was a big hit the first season, so they signed up for two more seasons, and they don't know what else to do. And so the middle section of Twin Peaks season two across two miniseries, it's the fucking Miss Twin Peaks beauty pageant, all that kind of bullshit. Frost and Lynch aren't involved anymore, and there's a bunch of people who just don't get it, just trying to do something like what they were doing and not quite getting there, and going to some weird, like, wannabe northern exposure places and stuff. I like that first miniseries fine, and I think that one holds up fairly well. It's these other two that I just can't get past, but I will agree with you. I do enjoy looking at Sam Keith's artwork. They kind of give up on the whole alterations thing during the Earth War / Female War thing. Obviously, they have Ripley, and they do excise like a couple of pages in one of the versions that directly references aliens, but they don't change everybody's names anymore. Kind of do the Billy thing and the Wicks thing a few times. But what's weird is in one of the editions, they will go back and they recolor it. And I think that the coloring that was done by Monica Livingstone for the first miniseries, particularly on that paper, you know, we've talked about this in the past, it was just the right color coloring for that kind of paper, where it was kind of garish and kind of colorful in a weird sort of way that sort of resonated with Sam Keith. And I think to some degree may have inspired the coloring that was used on the Max, but it's very appropriate to him. And it was not necessarily what you'd expect from Aliens, but it works very well within the context of the miniseries. And then these assholes go back and they recolor it. And like, there are these color holes that some of them work and some of them don't work too good. And they just go back and they turn them all into solid blacks. And everything is muted and everything's a fucking brown or a black or a dark blue. And there's a lot of flats. You can tell they didn't get a professional colorist. They just went in there, fill. And they just fucking butcher the coloring. And I get why they did it, because when you see the coloring and even in the reproduction of the artwork on glossier stock, it loses a lot of the lines. I think that they tried to like contrast it too much. And so a lot of those very delicate lines of Sam Keith's drop out. And the coloring also has that delicate quality to it that when you try to fuck with it, it just doesn't work. It really is made for a specific paper with a specific time period the miniseries came out in. But Dark Horse just butchered it when they went back and tried to recolor it again, and doing weird shit like coloring a spaceship brown. Who the fuck wants to fly in a turd through outer space? It's just, I don't know what the fuck they're thinking about that shit. I definitely prefer it on its own terms. I really prefer it as a miniseries on shitty paper from 1990. That's the best way to enjoy the book. I'm not sure how well it works after that.
That's the only way I've ever read it. That's my defense. I just gotta say, because it's my avatar, and you were like, hey, I know that chick. My favorite is that page, that last panel of Newt on that page 11 of issue 2. You're talking about like male gaze or something. Like, I don't know if it's male gaze. Like, I just think she looks beautiful in that. Like, not in the, I want to violate her or something like that. Not in that sense. It just looks like a beautiful piece of artwork. And it's only for that one, that panel is like her best MySpace picture she's ever taken in her entire life. I don't know what it is, but it's just that one, for whatever reason, speaks to me. That's my favorite panel in the book. And for Mr. Ryan Daly, that would be the page that I'd want from Earth War if I could afford it. I would get this page with the Newt profile on page 11. I think that's my favorite image in the whole book.
I'm trying to see which one that is. Are you talking about the one where she's surrounded in darkness and she's just sort of looking at the reader? Kind of has like a Sharon Tate kind of thing going on?
It's the one where she's looking at the photo, and then it's just that last panel where she says, not this time.
It's literally the fucking avatar. Okay, well, shit.
Yeah.
That is one of the better shots of Newt. The way her hair is wild and kinky and tangled, that feels Newt to me.
Yeah.
Why the fuck is Ripley Stevie Nicks?
Well, because she couldn't be Sigourney Weaver, because lawyers were going to get involved. So they said, fuck it, we'll just make her Stevie Nicks. Maybe the Prometheus model Stevie Nicks android took Ripley's place or whatever, based on what you told me about the novel version. I didn't realize that she was supposed to be like a synthoid or whatever the hell.
Instead of milky blood, it's just liquid cocaine.
That could work. Looking at it from a modern context, knowing what we know about, as you described, you know, Ridley Scott going up his own ass with the Prometheus stuff and all this other stuff, and then even I don't really want to talk about it, David and Alien Alien Covenant and all that other stuff. This is something that predates that, right? Where the original concept is that, what, Ripley gets an information flash from the space jockeys or whatever the deal is, right? And that she knows all this stuff about the aliens' home world and all that other stuff. But then in that context, it almost seems like she'd be like what's-her-face from the first Prometheus movie. But then if she's a replicant or she's a synthoid or whatever the fuck, then there's that weird aspect where they have David go on his little weird warp journey. So is she just a weird warp synthesoid that's doing all this crazy stuff that doesn't make any sense to you because she is a fake person? I like thinking about those kind of things, even though it doesn't make any logical sense. It's like a warped headcanon thing where I think I'm going back to my, you know, Transformers days where everybody was trying to make all the different canons fit, even though there's no way in hell they could, but you're still trying to make this fit into some kind of canon or something.
It's probably in part because there's a lot of what if in the air right now with the TV show on and everything else. This is just a really long what if to me. We buy in much more easily with a what if because we know it's not in continuity. I don't know why Ripley in some of these shots looked like she's fucking Marlena Dietrich and shit. I don't know why they went there, but it kind of doesn't matter because this is the story where Ripley's rocket ship lands in Soviet Russia. The more I accept it as this is a thing that isn't part of the continuity, the easier it is for me. I think I come off as being more mad at it than I am. I am frustrated because I would really love to read a story about Ripley's continuing adventures and what would have happened if she had lived and Newt had lived and everything else. And I don't get that. And that's what I really want out of these stories. But I don't hate it. It's fine. It's just, you know, it's just not what I really want. And sometimes it weirds me the fuck out. The Mary-Kate and Ashley Olsen turning 18 countdown bullshit from years ago. Can't I just watch my fucking Full House in peace without you guys making it all fucking twisted and sexy, you know? I just want to watch Dave Coulier and John Stamos. What the fuck? Why you gotta put the shit in my brain? I will say that while Sam Keith's aliens are a little wonky, I like his alien architecture. The bulbous masses and the way that the tunnels look. And there's this one shot where there's just like a sea of aliens rushing through the, like, it's sort of like the Jurassic Park with the when the dinosaurs are like going across the plains or what have you. And it's cool to see the aliens en masse looking like they're in their international environment and stuff. There's some really nice looking drawings in this miniseries and in all three miniseries. I'm just not as into the stories as I like to be. And it really is a shame too, because I've met Mark Verheyen. He's a great guy, just a real salty or a good person. And I don't want to run down his work. And I do think there are extenuating circumstances. I wonder sometimes, especially with the long production of these books, how much stuff changed over the course of it. What liberties did the artists take that they had to write around? You know, I really feel like there's some extenuating circumstances here, but just looking at it, it's a pretty book. It's an attractive book. As long as I don't invest too much in the story, cool, guys running around with power loaders, getting into fist fights with the aliens, fuck it, why not? I like seeing the shots in space, and I like seeing the distance shots.
No. Look, there's nothing wrong with having hopes and dreams, I'll put it, for fictional characters that you have come to appreciate. Maybe there is that aspect of you had a place where you envisioned them going, and unfortunately it's never realized. I always usually chalk that up to there are these attempts to reimagine, re-envision, recapture the zeitgeist that happened back then and do it in the present day. And I always think that stuff never works. But in your case, it's not like these stories were told in 2021 and they're like, we're gonna pick up where Aliens left off, but everything from Alien 3 on is not canon. It's not like it's a series of fucking Halloween movies where they're changing the sequel, the trajectory of it, all the timelines every 5 minutes. But where you came to these miniseries and really absorbed them, you had had that much distance and it wasn't what you envisioned the follow-up to be. You wouldn't care about it so much if you didn't love it, right? Like I said, these were things I was reading in real time, so I didn't quite have the same disconnect, other than I will acknowledge my bias is always going to be, regardless of whatever shortcomings the miniseries might have, I always felt like enjoying these miniseries was sticking it to Alien 3 somehow. So, like, there's that aspect for me, I suppose. Haha, this is better than Alien 3 or something like that. But other than that, to me, the selling point of this is the Sam Keith art. I think like you, I probably had seen him in Marvel Comics Presents first and then maybe this. But it's like, I don't think I was familiar with his work on Sandman and things like that until much later. So like there were certain things of his that I had never experienced. And I guess I see what you're saying, like the whole, you know, Max and Zero Girl and all that other kind of stuff. The female forms were not necessarily always quote unquote idealized, but I still think there's some of that in this. I always looked at them as real women, and I know that sounds weird to say, but I mean, I think you picked up what I'm putting down. They're not Jim Lee, you know, with bolt-ons or whatever it is, right? It's not all silicone and fakeness. It's like these characters seem, even if they're male gazey and sexualized or whatever terminology you want to use, to me, there's still a down-to-earth gaze or a down-to-earth sexualization as opposed to almost mannequin-like or robotic in nature. Maybe that dampens the gaze or sexuality for me. The clothes may be skin tight, but you gotta admit, there's a shit ton of wrinkles, too. That, in and of itself, negates the skin tight. Well, all I'm saying is, it's not fucking Jim Ballant, man. Like, there are wrinkles in the clothes. Like, even if they are form-fitting, right? Like, so, there's that. I feel like it's half-hearted praise. I enjoyed this when it came out. I'm revisiting it now, and yeah, there's certain things I could look at with a lot more of a critical eye, especially the whole resolution. Like, I get what you're saying. The engineers or space jockeys or whatever the fuck you want to call them, and you're making me laugh. The super aliens and super queen, and I get it. That's the easiest way to designate it. I'm trying to make it all complicated, call her patient zero alien queen or whatever, but you know, it is what it is. She's a super queen, okay, fine. Like, you know, and it's not like there was a whole hell of a lot of explanation over why that is, other than it's the alien's home planet. When you first are introduced to that, that's probably Ripley getting a data dump download and knowing where the alien's home planet is. I think at the time, that's kind of like your 13 to 15 reading Spawn, thinking it's super cool, the big guns. And when I watched the HBO Spawn thing when I was an adult, it was ridiculous. It's tits and cursing, and I'm like, that's not mature, but it's adult, or it's not adult, but it's mature. I don't know what the right way to say it is, but basically there's some things about it that it's what would seem adult to a 13-year-old, and there's plenty of things in this that would seem cool and adult to a 13-year-old, but of course, we're no longer 13, so it's easy to pop the hole in that 13-year-old balloon and go, this isn't so cool, this is kind of dinky and stupid at point. There's nothing you could do about that, but maybe the things you're seeing is DiDio influence or editorial influence. Maybe it was just marketing. Maybe they knew what their audience was, and they were just, okay, this is going to go out to 12 and 13-year-old boys. They'll think these giant guns and telepathy. Telepathy's hot. Everybody loves the X-Men. You know, like whatever it was, they were just trying to capitalize on nonsense that doesn't make fucking sense is hot, because the X-Men. Throw some of that in the aliens. You're like, I don't know. Maybe that's all it was. So.
You just made me flash back to the space jockey, and like we're introduced to him in the first miniseries where he's gone to a planet and he's gunning down aliens, two-fisted action. And then somehow by the end of it, it's like, no, what I really want to do is conquer the Earth and terraform it. So you might as well go ahead and nuke it. It's the only reference to him outside of text is like a silhouette of the space jockey in one panel. And it's like, this is like a pivotal character in the resolution of the whole series. Like, or like how they spent all that time with the morality and the viability of a romantic relationship with a synthezoid, and then like they don't even mention it at all in the mini, or like it's a big victory because they make it to the Earth and they save two suicidal dudes and one little girl, and everybody else can fucking die, you know, it doesn't matter. It's just so much shit where it's like, what, why, how, super queen. Okay, I will say though, this is the first miniseries that brings in the John Bolton covers, and Bolton was very closely associated with aliens for years, and I do think that he gave them a real sense of respectability. It seemed like they kept going after guys who did Sandman, because you had Sam Keith, and then later on you had Kelly Jones, and I do think that gives them this vertical quality to them. And Bolton, while he was never as fantastic as a H.R. Giger, there's something about him being true to the Giger designs, and then having his mannequin-y, creepy humans that he does, and I love the way he draws. I'm not trying to disparage, but like sometimes they have this sort of like not a lifelessness, but like a somnambulance about them. Like they seem like they're like only like three quarters of the soul is present in these people, and it gives it a real strong sense of horror. And so to have these people interacting with the accurate Geiger aliens, I do very much enjoy Bolton's covers. I like the ideas that he presents in those covers, and I think that he really helps to give aliens a much needed consistency going forward, making it feel like it's part of that Geiger Ripley Cameron zone that I want them to aim for.
Oh, damn it. Computer switch to ship's log. Start recording. Official log. Final report of the commercial starship Nostromo. Third officer reporting. The other members of the crew, Kane, Lambert, Parker, Brett, Ash, and Captain Dallas are dead. Cargo and ship destroyed. I should reach the frontier in about 6 weeks. With a little luck, the network will pick me up. This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo, signing off. Computer, close the hypersleep chamber and shut down all but the core systems. Take me home. Come on, cat.
This month's manifest includes hashtag socially distant, Anthony Perconti, Baba Lament, Between the Pages blog, bottalk.com, CH, Canoes, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, Dear Watchers, a Marvel What If podcast, Del Dracula, Doc Strange, Dirk Ashton, Ed Moore, Fanholes podcast, Franco Benitez, The Hammer Strikes, Geeky Stuff and hashtag voiceover, History of Comics on Film, Iowa's Joe Crawford, J. David Weeder, James Chase, Jeffrey Brown, They Them, Jerry High, JMT Productions, Keith G. Baker, Kenbo, Kirk Spencer Says, It's a Madhouse, a Madhouse, Lamar the Revenger, Lucretia, Mark Thomas, Mike at Send Aliens to Me, Mission di Solidarietà, Paul K. Bisson, Ryan Daly, Saigenu Official, Sensational Gus, Siskoid, Tim Price the Pod Crasher, Tora, Oofda, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace Podcast. Doc Strange added, Awesome Art, Del Dracula noted, in case you have an extra $95 laying around. I want to introduce you to a personal friend of mine and share the pre-order page for Nerf's LMTD Aliens M41-A Blaster. It comes with a 10-round magazine and can fire sponge darts, both as a regular rifle and as grenade with pump action. That's still available for pre-orders through the end of October. Anthony Perconti asked, whatever happened to Dennis Beauvais? His style was distinct, to say the least. Warlock 5 was a stunner as well. I had planned on going into Beauvais' work in more detail in that episode, but it was already long enough without that. I think that the broad strokes are still there, though. He did a bunch of covers. He did a Frankenstein painted adaptation, and then he moved into computer-generated imaging and video games. Oofda wrote, God damn, you guys went on a deep dive. Comic surgeons, well done. And finally, Ryan Daly wrote, love this discussion. The whole episode I was thinking, bring on more Derek. So it was nice to hear he'll be back next time.
This has been a Roald Spine podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
They mostly come out at night, mostly. It was nice when it was over to move on.
Coming in October. Dark Horse presents